You want to start? We can start. We can try your way.
Sure.
All right.
The plan doesn't need to make sense to me for the plan to be effective.
You're listening to Deeper Magic.
Hi, this is Deeper Magic. I'm Anna. Say hi, Peter.
Hi, Peter. So we have a special episode today. We did last week where we did part one of your India trip.
Mm-hmm.
And we are intending on doing part two of your India trip.
Okay, you were right. It is really hot in here. Sorry.
Yeah, see, I know I was right. You turned on a space heater in a room.
It was because I was driving with my windows down. So
yeah. Well,
that's why.
So, well, and it wasn't hot in India when you were there. Oh, here's this person.
Okay, oh, okay.
Okay.
Should I take my headphones off?
I think you should leave.
Okay. Yeah, I'll be back.
Okay. Hey, I can hear you. Let me just see if, make sure you get through the soundboard here. Make sure I got that set up. It should be coming through. Check 1, 2.
All right.
Yes, I can hear you. Great. You're on my headphones. So I actually literally just kicked Anna out of the room, and that was maybe the most fun part of my day. Okay, good. Well, you're on the line. We actually, we're just diving into getting started with it. So I'm going to call Anna back in, and then I'm going to do a short intro that'll somehow cue you in. So if that works for you.
Yep.
Okay, here we go. Here, she's coming back in right now. Again, favorite part of my day was she's 21 and I haven't been able to 22 and I haven't been able to boot her out of the room for a while. So that was really fun. All right. So Anna, you're back. Special guest is on the line, of which the person of whom you do not know.
And I don't know who this person is. I don't know what we're talking about today. You're like, we're podcasting on Tuesday. And
well,
I was
we were
like,
going to
okay.
talk about part two of your India
we
trip
were.
And what you were going to talk about, some of the spiritually other experiences that you had there. That would have been quite interesting after talking about what it meant to sacredly honor another person's story. But then the circumstances presented themselves that we could bring a special guest who probably would be somewhat familiar with this idea of what we were going to talk about anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the background was, for me, when we lived in Scotland, and I know you made a lot of friends in Scotland, mm-hmm. But my time was spent in school.
I don't know why that sounded passive aggressive, but it did. You're like, I know you made a lot of friends. No, I know it wasn't,
you know,
but there was
me.
A minute in my... Keep going. Yes, I made friends in Scotland.
Friends,
you were in school.
Yes, thanks for highlighting my loneliness. So when we were in Scotland and when I went to university, it was a very difficult time there to try to do my doctorate. I felt disoriented all the time and confused. I really didn't feel up to the task quite often. And it was far more difficult than I would have imagined. And not only that, I entirely failed out from my first dissertation attempt. And you know that part of the story where I got laughed out of the room. But thankfully, I had an advisor at that time named Elizabeth Copian, who is the chair for Christianity of the non-Western world. And she was able to look at me and say, hey, look, I know what the problem is here. You're an American student. And when you hear you need to make an argument about something, you assume that you need to argue why you're right and everybody else is wrong because you're from the States.
Yeah, I had a research professor once who said that it doesn't actually matter whether or not you're right. It just matters if you're the loudest voice in the room.
Yeah, well, I think she had a number of American students, and that was exactly her experience. She said, you have a good PhD in here somewhere, and I'll help you tease it out, because to make an argument here in Britain simply means to make a statement and then support that statement through reliable research methods. And so she really helped me. And she was just sometimes with a twinkle in her eye and sometimes with a less than twinkle in her eye. She went page by painstaking page with me. She would sometimes say, I don't even like you. I just like your wife. And that's why I'm doing this. Or in classic British fashion, what in the hell were you thinking on this page? And so
you can swear, but I can't.
Well, I'm just quoting her.
Just quoting her.
So we got to the end of it. And the point of that is I would have never made it through university, or at least through that part of the program, without Elizabeth Copian. I will forever be in her debt. And I got to thinking a little bit about your journey at Bethel and where you've been.
I think I was right.
You think you know this?
Keep going.
Yeah, so knowing that you wanted to bail at certain times and knowing that it was not an easy process, knowing that you also spent some time in Edinburgh and came back, I know how meaningful the last 18-ish or so months have been, that you also have an advisor that has been quite helpful in getting you through to the end where you have just a couple months left. And so with that, since you clearly knew, and I was not able to surprise you the way that I would like to, but why don't you go ahead and introduce your advisor who is currently on the phone with us.
Hi, April.
Hi, Anna.
I'm so glad you're here. This is going to be so fun.
This is great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So one of the things that I thought we could talk about, Anna, that was quite intriguing, and I can let you guys pick up the conversation from here, is you came home from school one day after having had a class with April, and you talked about a comparative distinction between doing things where you're being productive versus bearing fruit in the work that we're doing. And it actually was something that made me think about kind of, I guess, maybe the callousness sometimes of my own day when I'm just going out and I have to sort of produce something in order by some metric to continue forward with my vocation or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And so I would just love for you to pick up the conversation, you and April, and talk a little bit about what this difference is between being productive and bearing fruit, because I think it has a lot of implications, not just for a vocation, but for relationships, for our faith, just all the way across the board.
Yeah, absolutely. April, the thing that I was telling my dad about was the idea of how being part of a creative process is something that is going to inherently be consumptive of you. It is going to take away from you. It is going to take energy. It is going to take time and effort and emotional capability. But how do we do that where we're also being fruitful and we're also gaining energy and passion and light and life from that instead of just letting it consume us in the like American capitalistic sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so we were talking about that, and we were talking about, I brought in the idea, this wasn't from when I took StoryForge from you, but when I took it from Scott and you came in and spoke to our class briefly about the idea of part of being fruitful is letting yourself fail. And I am going to swear because this was the quote, because when shit happens, that's the fertilizer.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And that's how you grow things out of that. That's how you become fruitful. It's all of our ideas of the elevator test as well and all of that. And it just really had reshaped how I think about the creative process. But if you wanted to talk a little bit about that idea of like being fruitful in the elevator test and like all of that, that would be super helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to make sure to acknowledge the process and kind of the, I guess the evolutionary process of the food chain of ideas. I first encountered this concept of shifting from productivity towards fruitfulness from theologian Bonnie Macklemore Miller. Mm. She did writing on, she's got one book about caring for children as a spiritual practice called In the Midst of Chaos. And then another one about contemplation that really essentially asks the question, not in so many words, but do you have to be in a really privileged, rarefied state in order to participate in the contemplative life? And, you know, one of the things that we sort of joke about in classes is, okay, I'll be a great writer when I have a stone cottage on the coast of Ireland, right? That's my creative process. That'll be the day. But having children and trying to figure out how to be a working artist and how to do this work sustainably. I started thinking more and more about what does it really mean to be working with living words? What are living words? And what is the culture that we're surrounded with? And we've got in the U.S. and I think in a lot of Western European culture, post-industrialism, you know, post-enlightenment, all of those energies. We have this idea of productivity and you have to produce or die. And then that's turned in the U.S. into consumption, that it's our job to consume and that's become like the filter that we see things through, that you're either producing or consuming. And those are the two options. But the natural world doesn't work that way. I started to realize that I think there are a lot of assumptions, particularly in the Gospels and even in the stories of the Old Testament, where the paradigm that those stories are being told in does not assume this, you're either consuming or producing setup. And it's much more akin to some of the cycles of the natural world. And it's interesting, Anna, that you were saying that the creative process is going to take something from us. And then how do we do that? And in ways that don't just empty the tank. And I think it's our work and challenge. And I think it's possible to find ways to live and work in the arts and even in the life of faith that we're not participating, that we're doing like the anti-consumption thing, where actually what we're trying to do is be generative and that the thing is self-sustaining, and that maybe that's the life abundant. Maybe that's a form of eternal life, that we're not stuck in the economy of you're either spending or hoarding, basically. And there's a bunch of stuff that goes off of that, but it's more a paradigm shift than running a different mechanics, right? It's sort of taking the way that we look at the arts and how we relate and what we do together to be less like arithmetic and more like a calculus, or like the difference between physics and quantum physics, right? They're the same and they've got an overlap, but the way you look at things is different. And as soon as it's starting to look at practices instead of products, generativity instead of consumption, you start to get cycles. And the joke about swearing, you know, this is the swear in my notes in class is that you're not then either succeeding or failing. It's what does a farmer do with garbage? Well, there is no garbage. There's no waste. On a farm, you compost. That's what becomes the soil for the next thing. And what that does to the human psyche and spirit, when you can sort of shift from an economy and I'm either spending things or I'm protecting the wealth and the resources I have, versus okay, I can take some risks, I can offer some things out, and I'm participating in a cycle that will generate and regenerate and that will nourish, even if it doesn't turn out the way that I had hoped. And the escalator test is a really practical way to come at that. Anna, do you want to talk a little bit about how the escalator test worked in your project that you were doing?
Happened? And first of all, I wanted to say something when you're talking about, either being a product or like being productive or being consumptive, right? Part of that too, mm-hmm. and part of the challenge of creating something, of creating art, is the idea of like, that there are people who are going to consume this. And so then the temptation is to try and get as many people to consume it as possible and to kind of tone down the art as much as you can to make it consumptive for other people. And that's the thing that I'm like, so many of my favorite books are ones where as you're reading them, you can tell the author doesn't care if you get it or not.
Yeah, that was such a good example. And I was thinking, and this will date me a little bit, but I was a fan of John Grisham novels, and especially mm-hmm. like his first, to use April's word, this generative work of A Time to Kill. I know that when he speaks of that book that he wrote, he said it was years in the making, and it came from this sense of internal energy and passion, and it comes out in the pages. It's a heart-wrenching, incredible tale of racism and justice and advocacy, and I couldn't put it down in mm-hmm. terms of what was there. But it also then created this sort of popular image of Grisham, and everybody was like, so when's the next book coming out? And then the firm was still solid. It wasn't anywhere near the level of what A Time to Kill was. And then it went into like Pelican Brief and Rainmaker, and there's a diminishing return with each of them as he began to have to churn out novels to meet the expectations of the consumer, that by the time I got to book 7 or 8, it was just same song, 8th verse or 7th mm-hmm. verse, where he just kind of told the same story over again. So it's a really interesting idea of somebody that I'm not going to claim to know John Grisham's interior world, and I think he's a tremendous author, but I will say that my experience of reading the pages has felt like I would imagine if I was him, I wouldn't like the pressure of having to generate in the midst of productivity versus more cyclical, like April's talking about. But I'm curious about the mm-hmm. elevator test.
Yeah,
too,
the escalator test.
Escalator. Thank you.
So the way that we talked about it in class is the idea that if an escalator breaks, you still have stairs. So even if it doesn't have the function that you originally intended it to have, you still have a product that is usable and workable by the time it's complete. So if the escalator breaks, you still have stairs. You can still get from the first floor to the second floor. You're just not going to get carried up by moving stairs, right? So that's the idea. And it was something that we talked a lot about in our own projects. We've talked about a lot in previous episodes, Storyforge and my process of writing a novel and like this whole thing, trying to figure out what this project was going to be and what it was going to look like and what I was hoping would be the end result of it. And it's interesting because I think in a lot of ways, I succeeded in doing what I was trying to do. And then I got to the end of it and I realized, oh, I've been trying to build like 120 different escalators and about half of them are stairs. and so by the time I finished, I was like, okay, so I feel like I have an idea of how to create tone and maybe how to set up a very complicated plot structure, which April sat through a couple of different sessions with me of me just word vomiting plot ideas at you and putting them on the whiteboard and trying to sort it all out.
I do remember that story.
Yeah, it was fun. But
it was fun.
A lot of my stares at this point are, okay, how do I build character in the way that I want to build character? How do I shape a plot in the way that I feel like gets that emotional impact by the end of it? Because I was able to structure a really complicated plot, but I didn't feel like it quite had the emotional impact that I wanted by the end. And so it was one of those where there was so much that was such a learning process that I'm now trying to work through in my next project. How do I build character? How do I build plot mm-hmm. and suspense? And how do I get us to the point where this feels like it has been inevitable the whole time, but you still don't really believe that it was ever going to happen, like all of this. And so I'm simplifying the things that were successful from my last project and kind of setting those aside and being like, okay, I feel like I know how to do that now in some capacity. Mm-hmm. And now I'm going to take these other things that ended up being stairs and focus on trying to turn them into escalators.
Sure. Fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we could look at your process, Anna, and say, well, you know, you did some things that were a success and some things that were a failure. Right. I mean, right. Even the stuff that you wrote that didn't end up in the manuscript, mm-hmm. is that a failure? I mean, under a certain definition of perfection, it is. But I think there are possibly different tracks to perfection. And the track that we tend to assume, at least in the U.S., is that perfection comes through precision.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That and anything that's outside of that product mm-hmm. or anything else is a failure. It's imperfect. But there, I think there is also a track to perfection that comes from profusion, or if we're going to use dangerous words, promiscuity, right? Like let's mm-hmm. try all kinds of things. And then you have to be willing to get all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But if this manuscript, you know, if your writing practice, Anna, is an orchard, right? We could look at the book as a certain thing. You're trying to grow an apple tree with this book. And trees play heavily in this manuscript, which I love, all the, mm-hmm. the symbolism and everything with the Celtic landscape and all of that. But, if the only thing you're trying to do and on this like perfection is precision track is grow apples, then if you end up with a cherry tree, it's a failure.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Right. But in this wider kind of process, if you can open it up and say, okay, I'm going to try to learn a bunch of things about writing. I'm going to try a bunch of things. I'm going to have a practice here and my product will come out of that practice. Then the apple tree is welcome. The cherry tree is welcome. The grapevines that are growing across the ground are welcome. The rosemary that happens to be coming in, it's not a weed anymore. It's just, oh, maybe that's not for now, but it's still part of the whole orchard. So then you're able to take this manuscript that's your apple tree and go, look, I have an apple tree, and then figure out what to do with the cherries, with the rosemary, with the grapes, with anything else. And in my experience, that there can be many things here, and my work is to grow them all and then figure out where they belong and what to do with them. That's so much less crushing than ending up with a whole tree full of cherries and going, I guess I failed
mm-hmm.
because I have a different thing than I was planning, which is ridiculous, because then that also assumes that we already know where we're going to end up, which fun is that? Who wants in a relationship or in a poem or in a novel to end up with exactly what you thought you were going to have? That doesn't seem like living. That seems more like an autopsy or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking, April, as you're talking, now I'm like, my mind is already exploding and I'm starting to write down some notes just even mm-hmm. about the parallels outside of the world of arts, even things like our faith journey and all of these places. So I want to return to those in just a second. But one of the things that felt quite inviting as you were describing that is that I think there, you use the word crushing, and I think I often feel a fair amount of crushing pressure if I am not being productive at the results that I assume I'm supposed to be productive within. And it sounds like the life that you're describing within, at least starting point within the context of the arts, would be a life that I would want to wake up into and wonder what's going to emerge in that day. And it wouldn't feel like it would have the same amount of stress and pressure that there's some outcome at the end of this that has to be achieved within my next 9.5 hours. You just get to continue to stay within all of it.
Right. And I think it is important to note that it can sound kind of posh, right? Oh, I'm just going to wake up and play.
Sure.
And like, I don't have to make anything. Well, that's fine. But we also would like to, you know, house and clothe and feed ourselves.
Right.
So something that can have a paycheck and that we have made some things, but, and there is tremendous rigor in focusing on practice instead of product. In some ways, you can coast on talent and luck if you're focused on product, because maybe I didn't have to work that hard and I got lucky and had a good chapter or a great idea for a character. But if I'm focused on practice, I got to put in my time, even if some of it seemed to kind of come by magic. And that feels to me a lot like parallels with prayer. Mm. Are we focused on getting kind of a return on our investment, or is it a practice and a relationship that we're engaging in? But that shift away from it, it's less crushing if I'm not focused exclusively on product. And for me, it opens a space for wonder and curiosity. And that makes my work better when I have a posture of wonder and anticipation and curiosity versus nose to the grindstone. I got to slam out these words and it's got to be good. You know, there's got to be magic in it.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And Anna, I'm wondering about your experience of that. Cause I saw little bits as we would check in. But it seemed to me that it worked for you. You got a full manuscript, even if sort of experimenting with maybe I approach this differently, you still ended up with a book.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that when I came into Storyforge and we started having these kinds of conversations, this manuscript was something that I had been working on for the better part of 2 to 3 years. And so I'd already gone through a lot of the phases of, oh, this doesn't work. Oh, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. I don't remember if I ever said this to you, but I had this conversation with one of my classmates at one point where I was like, oh yeah, originally about a third of this book took place on a train. Now there's no train in this book. but that was the original idea. Like that was where the original thought came mm-hmm. from. And then that piece of it eventually got taken out of the manuscript. And so now being in the process of starting a new project, I'm applying these in ways that I wasn't always able to apply to the previous project. I was able to apply a lot of it, but it had kind of already gone through so much of that metamorphosis mm-hmm. that there wasn't a lot of that work left to do. And so now I'm at a point where I'm like, okay, I have my cast of characters. I know where we start. I know where we end. I have no other information about how we get there or what happens in between, or even like why the ending is what happens. And so mm-hmm. now I'm just kind of throwing seeds in the dirt and putting people in scenes and being like, okay, what if this thing happens? What if that thing happens? Like anywhere from 5.5 pages of what if this scene were to take place, and just seeing what grows out of that to kind of try and piece together a semblance of a story. And then mm-hmm. I know that I'm going to get into it and I'm going to start getting through the process and I'm going to be like, oh, not that. Never mind. Maybe I need this tree instead. Maybe I don't need the rosemary, but maybe I do need lavender. And how do I build this from there?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard it said in parallel to farming that that there are people who love the crop, but a real farmer loves the soil, like loves the earth, loves the dirt, that's what they're farming and investing in. And it sounds like that kind of paradigm, that now you've got these characters and it's, okay, I'm investing in this world, in this whole system and kind of ecology that's going to grow a book. But I'm not so entirely focused on exactly this chapter or that chapter, but we're going to get to know this whole thing and dwell in this world a little bit. Sorry, Peter, you were saying?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly in the right where I was kind of thinking about some things too. And even just thinking for you, Anna, sometimes I hear authors talk about the idea that they didn't know their character was going to develop in this way. And I would sit back and say, what?
Yeah.
What are you talking about? You knew exactly the plot from start to finish. But what you two are talking about right now, it gives me better insight into you probably just don't even genuinely know where your character. If you didn't know that this was ultimately not going to be on a train, then maybe at the end of the day, you don't for sure know where a character is going to go. Did you experience some of that in your writing?
Oh, absolutely. And I got to a point after working on the project for long enough where I felt like I knew the characters. And so as I was working with other people and bringing in ideas and being like, I have to get from point A to point B and I don't know how to get there. And somebody would come up with a suggestion like, what if this character did this? What if this character did that? And my wonderful favorite author, Maggie Stiefvater, has talked about how there is only so far that you can push a character before it is too far. And now you've gone to the point where you can't bring that character back into somebody that the audience is invested in. And so it's the idea of she has a character in her books who is a relatively dark character. He has a lot of really horrific things that have happened in his past. And part of that then comes with some really troubled family dynamics that he's dealing with. He has a very rocky relationship with his older brother, but a very sweet relationship with his younger brother. And she was like, I can have him fight with his younger brother. I can have him say awful things to his younger brother. If he were to do something that would actively put his younger brother in harm's way, that would be the point of having pushed him too far, where then the audience is like, this isn't the character that I know and love anymore. And sometimes you can use that to your writer's point. But I got to a point in my thing where I was like, okay, I had to discover who these characters were in order to know how they would or wouldn't behave and what would be pushing them too far.
Yeah. That reminds me of kind of the multiple definitions of the word true, right? Is it true as you're looking at that character and what are they going to do? We could look at that and say, is it correct? But really what you're looking for is it aligned? Like true, like a plumb line, right? Does this align with that character? And at a certain point you recognize, oh, okay, this is true in that way. You know, maybe it's a little t true, that you've spent the time. And so was it a waste to discover that, oh, one of the things I could do is put the brother in harm's way, you know, for the author to do that? No, because then she knows the edges of that character and can move around within that world. And it sounds like that's kind of what you're recognizing within your own writing process, maybe.
Absolutely. And it's part of what I'm doing right now, just throwing people into scenes and being like, how do these characters interact with each other? Is because I'm trying to get a sense of who they are and how they behave in the world. And what are the parameters of this character? And so what kind of situations can I put them in that are reasonable within their characters, that are aligned with who they are, that will still get us to this end goal?
So can I ask the two of you one question, like a functional question, returning to something that April said about sort of just posh and just get it up into the day and be able to explore some things, right? But conditioned by the idea we have to eat and work within certain parameters at certain times. So my first question is functional. The other one's maybe a little bit dangerous theological question. Start with the functional. So you're a coffee shop barista, Anna.
I am, yes.
And so you can't necessarily wake up into your day and have a customer say, I want a certain kind of coffee, and you get to go to the coffee machine and say, I wonder what's going to emerge from the coffee machine today. Like, you know, so you sort of have to come back with a latte with whatever the ordered ingredients are. So I'm just curious how the two of you would speak to, is it possible that within that kind of just a vocational situation, you can practice this sort of generativity that you're describing, or do you almost need like a functional job just to pay the bills, but then have some sort of life outside of it where you're practicing this, or does it depend on the vocation? I mean, do you hear the question? I'm thinking about people listening that have a wide variety of vocations and how can we practice this within any vocation, or are there some we just can't?
Yeah. April, do you want to start this one off or do you want me to take it?
You jump in. I want to hear what you have to say. I want to learn.
Yeah. I think first of all, With the coffee shop idea, this is more of a side note than a direct answer to your question. One of the funny things that happens far too often is that I know what the customer ordered, and I know that I can't be like, oh, I wonder what's going to come out of the coffee machine. And then sometimes I hand it to the customer and they're like, what is that? And I'm like, it's what you asked for. I had somebody tell me the other day that her Americano was watered down.
Oh.
And I was like, an Americano is espresso and water. You're correct. It is watered down. If you would like a little more espresso in it, I can do that. But I was like, ding, ding, ding. We have a winner. Like,
we are aligned right
now. Correct.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. So there is an element of that in coffee, which is very fun. But I think I find it in other ways in coffee. I don't want to say that it's a creative process necessarily, but it kind of feels like it is in some ways, especially having all of the different recipes. Okay, I guess maybe I will say it's a creative process, because I was going to say it's like baking, where you have the recipe in front of you, and if you don't follow the recipe, you're not going to get the product that you wanted. And I think it's a little similar to novel writing, in the sense that if you don't have the basic ingredients of a novel, if you don't have a plot and characters and structure of some kind and whatever, then it's not really a novel by the time you're done with it. But depending on what recipe you have in front of you, you'll end up with a cake or a pie or muffins or whatever, right? So you can end up with a lot of different things, but they all kind of have the same basic ingredients. And coffee is very similar to that. And so I'm making hundreds of different drinks in a day, and I'm working with about 15 different recipes, but then it's like, okay, maybe we'll sub that for that. Maybe this goes in here instead, and this thing. And then I'm pouring latte art, which is something that takes time and intentionality.
Your latte art is cool too. Yeah,
it's really fun. But that is something that is a little bit of a breath in my day, is getting to pour the latte art, because it's something I've been talking about weirdly a lot with my coworkers lately, is the idea of, like, it's down to the angle at which you steam the milk and how long you introduce air into the milk to create foam. And it's such an intentional process. And if you do it quickly, you will not have latte art by the end of it. You will have a milk blob and it's gross.
Right.
And nobody wants that. And so there is an element of, like, okay, everything around me is insane right now. I have to stop and let that fade away and do this, and it's going to take me about a minute and 30 seconds. And by the end of it, I'm going to have something beautiful that I didn't have a minute and 30 seconds ago. Wow. And then I have to turn around and make 57 other drinks. And so it's like this, there is an element of creativity and intentionality around it.
Mm-hmm.
And then getting to turn around and hand that drink to somebody and be like, this is something that you're excited about, and I just made it beautiful.
That's amazing.
And so there is an element of generativity in it that is really lovely.
I like that. Yeah. April, any thoughts on this one too?
Yeah. Some of the things that I find the most demanding in life are when you can't toggle, like when you have one life and that you're living, and potentially a single vocation or main calling. And so it's not like, you know, the decision of, am I going to step out of my calling or my kind of spiritual life to pay the bills, right? That sort of thing has become for me a question of, how can I look through it? So if I have to make a meal, the problem is I have to make a meal, and it's going to take my time for writing or my time for prayer or whatever it is. But can I live in such a way that the meal is the product that I get on the way to where I'm going? And so maybe it's that, like Anna's saying, there's craft and intention in the latte art. If what I'm trying to do is be present, it's good for me as a writer to know how things feel and smell so that I can describe them, to be attentive and observant. I can do that while I'm chopping peppers. And while I'm sauteing things, and I get a meal for me and my kids on the way there. Simone Weil has an essay on the right use of school studies, in which she basically says, fine, go to school. Like, that's good and important. But really, the use of your studying is, it teaches you to pay attention, which means it's teaching you how to pray. And so there's sort of an ordering there, and it's an ordering that's not competitive. It's not like Anna can either make a cup of coffee, or she can give gifts with craft and intention. She's doing both of those. But she's ending up with an Americano along the way. But her sort of soul and spirit and attentiveness and vision can grow. That's what she's about. Even though she can pop out of that and hand somebody a, you know, a cup with a cardboard liner on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the second question, I know, April, you have just a couple minutes left, right? Before you have to run.
Yeah. Well, I've got a meeting at 4, so I need about 5 minutes to get there probably.
Okay.
So we got a little bit more time.
Okay, great. So I'll ask the potentially dangerous theological question and just condition this with the idea that I'm going to just go ahead and suggest that I don't think this will be terribly scandalous to suggest that maybe God and the way God is in the world is not fully and totally defined by two people in the Protestant Reformation. Right? Okay. So like the way I think about God and kingdom life and faith and even the 26 characters of the English alphabet that I have to work with to try to describe the experience of life with God in relationship. I say all of that because I think sometimes our faith can turn into more of sort of a daily echo chamber of what we already believe. And we're always looking to sort of already confirm maybe some very limited ways of understanding kingdom life. But now I'm thinking about, what if we just allow God to be God? And your description earlier, April, of what might all come in a garden that is unexpected, from cherry trees to rosemary bushes. Or is rosemary come from a bush? Is that a vine? Is that a...
Maybe.
I don't know. Does
bush.
It just come in a jar?
It is a bush.
It seems like it just comes in a jar. So, but you know what I mean? Like, if we just let God be God, God is always going to be true. God is always going to be aligned. But maybe God is going to be substantially different than the cherry tree we thought we were going to get on that given day. Does this make sense in terms of what is potentially dangerous, but I think important theological question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, it is. And I think it's what's been more dangerous in my life is living with the assumption that it's clear cut.
Yeah.
Because then my options are to either keep on believing or to stop.
Hmm.
If it's not the way that I expect, right? If it doesn't turn out the thing, if I approach the faith as a formula, like if I'm approaching a novel as a formula, I'm going to put this into the machine and it's going to kick this out. If I'm approaching my faith and my spiritual practice that way and it doesn't work out, and there are many, many things in my life that have not worked out the way that I anticipated, though I was a, 4.0, like, super type A, firstborn of a firstborn. If somebody was going to do things right, I did them right. Damn it. Right.
Yeah.
And it didn't turn out. And so somebody's doing something wrong, and either that's me. And then what do I do? There are a certain number of things that I can do. I can sort of adjust, but a little bit of that is just tinkering, or it's God. This whole God thing is wrong. if it's a formula approach. So I think while it's a dangerous question, I think it's more dangerous to proceed locked in that it really must be one way or another. And that if we can widen a little bit to maybe I look around and am attentive to what God might be doing or what is here, and then what do I make of that? Versus I'm trying to cram something into what I expected. I think that makes more space, potentially for God. And I should certainly hope that God's going to show up in ways beyond my imagination, or expectations. Otherwise, dangerously, I'm not sure that's a God that I want to worship.
And so,
Anna, I'm curious about your response to that too, because you're in a different stage of life too, in terms of trying to anticipate and the formation of, what am I going after? And how does my faith influence those decisions when you're in the thick of them versus, your dad and I are old geezers who have some hindsight, right?
Yes, I will resemble that remark too. So yeah, that's a great, Anna, I would love to hear on that too.
Yeah. First of all, I love what you said, April, about the idea of like, I want God to be more, to show up in more ways than I can imagine, because the idea of like, if we are creative people in such a way, the idea that we might be more creative than the God who created us is like, well, then how does that work out? So it is the idea of like, I want to be surprised by this. I want it to be something that I don't understand and something that I have to work at and is fluid and ever changing. And I'm always going to be discovering new facets of my faith and of my spirituality because I can't understand all of it. I can't fathom the imagination behind it. And part of that for me is I'm running in a lot of circles right now, oddly less circles than I did in high school, but I'm still running in circles where faith is a formula and where there are right and wrong answers. And it is, I'm going to point to this Bible verse with no other context.
Yeah.
And this is going to tell you everything that you need to know about God. And I'm going to quote a dead white guy about why that makes that true. And I'm like,
For everyone of all time.
Yep. Exactly.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what's been so interesting to me about that is that so much of my faith has come more from the Celtic spirituality, which Dad, you and I have talked a lot about. And April, you've seen the influence of it in my work, is the idea of, okay, this thing is way bigger than me. I'm not going to understand it. What I can do is what I've been doing, diving into the text, into the Hebrew, which I think is so reflective of the creativity of God in so many ways, so much more so than our English translations. There's so much nuance and connection and beauty and artistry in it that I'm like, I could and I hope to spend the rest of my life studying this. And I know that if I start now at 22 and study this until the day that I die, I'm going to maybe get 4% of it. And it's like that is where my faith is coming from, is actually a rejection of the idea of a formulaic faith and the idea of this is something that I can never fit into a formula. And if I do, it's not only an insult to me and my faith, it's an insult to God.
I love that. I just, maybe one more comment before we let you run, April, too, as you were talking. And I was just thinking, from growing up in the Catholic Church, one of the things that I appreciate and miss, and again, I mean, obviously, both the Catholic tradition and on all versions of Protestant traditions have their things, you know, so disclaimers aside, one of the things that I really missed about the Catholic Church when my parents became Protestants was, and I wouldn't have been able to name it when I was 10, of course I wouldn't, but later on in life, revisiting some of the writings and the practices, was that there's a sense of mystery in many of the ways in which people were living out their faith, including the centrality of the communion table had a mystery to it. But even they were more comfortable with the idea of mystery. And I think then, April, you were talking earlier about a sense of wonder and some of the other things. I find that if I'm willing to live in some mystery, then I also have the more possibility of wonder and adventure and uncertainty, and my spirit comes to life in a certain kind of way. I don't know if that's consistent with some of the things you were thinking about, but it just made me think about, I miss some of the mystery of faith from time to time.
Yeah, actually. And I've got a notebook in front of me that I'm scribbling on because it helps me to think, and mystery. And one of the things I wrote is that one of the main parallels between what I've learned in my spiritual life and in my creative life has had to do with the same sort of flip. And on the spiritual side, I feel like I've learned or am learning to love the divine mystery rather than being frustrated with it. Like, I don't know. Instead, learning to love that and find that as actually a source of nourishment and a sustaining, a kind of source with a capital S. In the same way that as an emerging or young writer, I hated revision, right? That it's going to be like, I dreaded it. And the idea was this perfection of, I'm going to write the first draft. It's going to be my only draft and then I'm done. And that's the ultimate goal, is that when I get better and better at being a writer, I will get more efficient. And I see this happen with students, and I think this began to happen in our seminar too, Anna, where at a certain point you begin to see revision as a gift, because then you can romp and play and discover in your first draft, because, oh good, I get to have some feedback. This doesn't have to be the final draft. And I can dwell in this in a different way and relate to it differently. And so this thing that used to be the bane of my existence, the revision or the not knowing, has actually become the kernel of sustaining that thing. The fact that I don't know is what brings me to the writing desk. And the fact that I don't know is what brings me back into contemplation, into a space of prayer. Because I'm going to find out. And then, like you're saying, Peter, that feels living to me. That feels alive in a way that this very contained, boxed in, we have the capital T answers, capital A, started to feel more dead to me. But it's been an interesting flip to have the thing that was what I dreaded and feared become really the source.
Fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was going to say something similar about that too. Frances Spufford, who wrote Unapologetic, which Dad, we've talked a lot about in April, I think you might actually really, really enjoy Unapologetic. But he talks about how life is not supposed to just be one thing. And that's the idea of the atheist bus that we've talked about, Dad, where the whole phrase of enjoy your life. And he's like, well, that's ridiculous. You can't only enjoy your life. Like, that's not how things work. And so the idea of revision and first draft and playing through that and trying to figure out where it is that you're going and where you're heading is the idea of that then the thing that you have by the end of it, when you have a finished final draft, is that then there is so much more life in it because it was so many things before you narrowed it down to what actually fit into this novel. You let it be life. You let your characters be life. You let it be messy and confusing and not fit together in the ways that you thought it was going to be. And then you narrowed it down into something that actually made sense. But the essences of that play are still evident in the work because you let yourself go through that process instead of plugging it into a formula.
Oh, man. Go ahead, April. Yeah. Yep.
I had a teacher just quickly who used to say, it goes into the atmosphere, right? Like that anything that you wrote or developed for a piece that doesn't end up in the final draft is in the atmosphere. So it's not wasted. It's a sort of sacrifice of first fruits, right? That it's gone into the air. Like, yeah, maybe it's burned up on a certain altar, but it surrounds you. It's just in a different form.
And well, unfortunately, I'll leave it there for now for you, April, just because I know you have to run. But I'll say I think I have somewhere in the neighborhood of 6,000 to 7,000 other follow up questions based on this. But now I also too, it's been sweet to have you on to be a part of this, because Anna would so regularly come home and be like, so we did this in April's class, and then April said this, and so just to watch the formative influence, but also to see some of the foundation stones, right, for you, Anna, just developing forward in your face. So April, just thanks for being a part of this. I'm sure that this isn't the last time the two of you are going to talk, but it was just really delightful to listen to the two of you.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me. This was wonderful. And just as with class, the great gift is that it is like theater in the round, right? We keep going, but anything, there's that generativity, right? Anything you offer out, like, this nourishes me too. And now I've got my matching 6,000 to 7,000 follow-up questions.
Yeah, so. Me as well.
All right. Well, we'll keep, there's a cycle to this from what I heard you say, April. So yes. We'll have to revisit this again for sure.
All right. Well, thank you both.
Yep.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon. Bye. Wow. Yeah, that was remarkable. I just was thinking again, just about like how relationships can go and discipleship can go, but even our change in vocations and just life in general. I mean,
absolutely.
We'll say all the time, right, that life is one big uncertain void in front of us. And we're always trying to manipulate circumstances to make the void feel more comfortable somehow, as opposed to maybe living in a different kind of way that April talked about.
Yeah, no. And it's funny because I think I hadn't had words for it actually before this conversation, but I think the way that I'm approaching my life and my faith and my work and my creative process and my academic process now, less so my academic process because I'm so close to graduation that I'm kind of adopting the mentality of it is what it is at this point. But so much of how I'm approaching my life at this point is similar to the creativity piece of it, where I'm going to try this and I'm going to learn something for it. And I might not have an escalator by the end, but I'm going to have something I'm going to have learned something, even if that's just how to build this thing. And maybe I'll never use that again, but then I get to know, okay, so if I do something else, I won't end up with this thing. I'll end up with something else. And there's just so much of that that has been so helpful in how I approach Hebrew study and in how I approach my faith and my relationships and my job and obviously writing as well.
So were you even remotely surprised, or
was there anybody,
did you have a handful of people that you thought might be possible, but
I kind of narrowed it down to two?
Can I ask who the other person was?
I was thinking Andrew Peterson, but I was like, that's so far out there. It was something that you had said the other day where you were like, you may not know this person personally, but you know of them. And that was when I was like, okay, so maybe not April. Because at that point I had been like
being a little deflective about the whole thing.
But I was talking with one of my friends about it yesterday, and I was like, Andrew Peterson maybe would make sense because you've worked with him on KTIS and whatever.
Right.
And so I was like, so that's a possibility. But then I was like, I kind of feel like it might be April, but I don't really know.
That was a good
call.
I
was like, I don't know what's going on.
Well, I certainly could have listened to the two of you for a much longer period of time. So I hope we get a chance to do that again, because I just Well, now Andrew Peterson is a good reference point because we listen to a talk that he gave not long ago that the artists need the theologians and the theologians need the artists. Mm-hmm. Like we need to work back and forth. And I think to have our faith informed by what you guys talked about within the context of generativity is so different than having our faith formed by orthodoxy. And it doesn't mean we shouldn't say things that are true about the kingdom, but that just gets to be cold. And it just gets to be, we sort of just recite and recite and recite versus maybe God's actually real. Mm-hmm. And maybe God is quite a bit more mysterious and more adventurous and more bonkers than we might guess. And so to open ourselves to the possibility, that's what I'm taking away from this conversation. So so glad that the two of you know each other. I hope that you continue to know each other after you graduate, but 2 more months left, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And April and I have talked about it and we hope to keep in touch after I graduate as well. And I've said this to you and I don't know if I've said it explicitly to her, but I've said it to you for sure. Where I was like, April is the reason that I am graduating at this point. Yeah. I would have dropped out easily a while ago if she had not helped me through this. So yeah,
for sure. Well, it's fun to have that kind of shared experience too. Like I said, with my advisor, I would have never made it through too. Mm-hmm. And to think about people in our life that you would say, I would never have except for, and then fill in that blank and you have that person in April. So that's great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, good. Well, this has been the Deeper Magic, everybody. Say goodbye, Anna.
Bye, Anna.
We'll talk to you guys next week.
Bye.
Deeper Magic is produced by Audio on the Rocks, and our music for this episode is Auroras of Saturn by Music L Files. You can head on over to filmmusic.io and find that there, all licensed under Creative Commons 4.0, viewable on the site as well.